suicide risk during the pandemic. The coronavirus pandemic and the uncertainty and isolation it brings has created widespread psychological trauma, including more people having thoughts of suicide. The problems are across age, gender, and racial groups, but seem even worse among first responders, caregivers, racial minorities, and young people. A major CDC survey this summer found that 25% of respondents between the ages of 18 and 24 reported having considered suicide in the previous 30 days. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Experts view suicide as a preventable tragedy. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk about how to recognize when someone needs help and what to do. Are you feeling vulnerable? Are you worried about someone you love? Join our conversation next on Maine Calling. But first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We may not know the degree to which the COVID crisis is taking on a toll on our mental health, but researchers have found an increase in suicide risk since the start of the pandemic. Today, we're going to discuss who is at most risk for suicide, from teens to marginalized people, and learn what signs to watch for and how to help. Joining me, Greg Marley, who is Clinical Director and Director of Suicide Prevention for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, in Maine. And David Prescott, a clinical psychologist at Northern Light Acadia Hospital. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you or someone you know struggling with depression or thoughts of suicide during these difficult times? What questions do you have about what to do and ways to find help? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Also, a quick announcement about Maine Calling. We're moving to a new time beginning this Monday, October 5th. We will be on live from 11 a.m. to noon, Monday through Friday. So tune in, please, a little earlier each day for the same interesting conversations. That is Maine Calling at a new time, 11 a.m. beginning next week. Our evening rebroadcast will remain at 7 o'clock. Well, back to you, Greg and David. Thank you so much for joining us today on the program. Greg, I'll start with you. You're really focused on suicide prevention. What are we seeing different right now? That is different right now during the pandemic. Even beforehand, suicide was on the rise, right?
Boy, it's been on the rise really since about 2006, and has only been increasing. And that's here in Maine and really all across the country. And the difference since the pandemic came is this has been a real stress on people's mental health, increases in anxiety and depression, and that enforced isolation at a time of real ongoing uncertainty and many people facing significant stresses financially and socially. All of those are drivers for increased risk of suicide.
David, what are you hearing from the people you work with?
Yeah, it's certainly the stuff that I hear in clinical practice is consistent with what the national survey is. People are struggling. We all know it, but it's the long-term nature of the pandemic. So, you know, our bodies are pretty well built to handle stress in the short run, but we're not that well designed either emotionally or physically to handle stress in the long run. And I would say, Jennifer, the other thing I worry about, not only the people that I see, but one of the biggest frustrations we have in mental health practice is that we think about half or maybe a little more of people with diagnosable mental health and addictive disorders never even get any treatment at all. They never get in our door. So I worry about those folks as well.
Why is that? Is that because they don't have health insurance that covers it, or is it because there's still stigma and people don't want to ask for help?
Oh, yeah. Can we do a whole show just on that sometime? Those are probably the two biggest things. We've done a really good job, I think, in groups like Greg's with NAMI have just done a fantastic job of making mental health problems and mental health treatment part of everyday conversation. So, but there still are people who just don't think that they should do something like that. And then there are you know, people feel like they can't afford it. They don't know who to call. There's a lot of barriers. I wish we were better at getting people in the door.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask you then, Greg, to speak directly to those people. I'm sure some are listening right now, people who could benefit from help, who need help, and for some reason are not reaching out. What do you say to them?
I say, you know, we live in a country and in an area where the stigma around suicide is so high. And part of the Yankee culture in northern New England is that sense of self-sufficiency and privacy and stoicism. And it makes it hard for someone who's really struggling to reach out. And it's even hard for their family or their friends to kind of urge them to do that. And the biggest thing is suicide prevention. Suicide is among the most preventable forms of death. And that prevention rests on all of us to connect and break isolation to get someone help.
I wanted to ask you about that because I see in the notes that this is something that you really want to stress, that you want to stress that suicide is a preventable tragedy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's most clear. You know, if you look at the people who make a significant suicide attempt, they're going through that dark time, and less than 10% of them go on to die by suicide. We just need to help someone through that dark time of crisis, and they reconnect to hope, they reconnect to help, and they live their life. And that's what I mean by preventable.
David, I want to ask you what you're seeing in terms of the people who are most affected. I'm reading caregivers, racial minorities, teens and young adults. Is this what you're experiencing in your practice?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, my practice, you know, Acadia Hospital up in the Bangor region, we have some folks who are in the minority groups, but just because statistically they are less a part of the population, I mean, we don't see as many. But I have caregivers and teens and young adults. I'm seeing a lot of, and sometimes people who haven't, I may have seen for treatment a few years ago for some other problem in their life. It's surprising how many are coming back in. They're just feeling the stress with this. And I think, you know, Greg brought up a couple really good points. It's at first an uncomfortable conversation, but when you talk with people who are considering suicide, if you can get past the worry of it, you find out that they are truly struggling. And the questions that they're struggling with, like, is there any hope? Does my life have a purpose and a meaning? On some level, they're questions that we all struggle with. And getting in there and talking with them and starting to help them feel like there might be some alternatives or some future that they aren't thinking of at the moment is exactly what gets them there. And to Greg's point, gets them through that window of time where they're intensely considering taking their own life, and they're meaningful conversations that if done well, you can actually kind of help a person propel forward in their life.
Okay, so this is what I really want to talk about, how to talk with someone you're worried about. But before we get there, and I'll turn to you for this, Greg, it's not like we're seeing each other like we did before. It's not like we're running into each other. I'm hosting this radio show from my family room. I'm not even seeing my coworkers. I may not know if one of them needs help. What is your advice, Greg, on even discerning whether or not someone is in a rough place?
Well, if it's just somebody in your life, rest on what you know about them already. You know, what are they normally like? And we pick up on those changes, those significant changes of behavior. We call them warning signs that say something's going on here. And it may not point directly towards suicide, but it often will point towards some kind of internal crisis. And when we see those changes that raise our concern, that's our invitation. That's everybody's invitation to say, hey, what's going on? I'm worried about you. So you're opening up that conversation with someone. And that's the start of it. It all begins with a conversation. And whether that's on the phone or through that ubiquitous Zoom call or even in writing. But yeah.
David, I think so many people are worried about saying the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've never, as a professional or you know, with my friends and family, if I ask somebody if they're feeling down or if they're feeling suicidal, that is never the first time that they've had the thought. And I have I cannot think of a time when something that somebody has said has, if you will, pushed a person over the edge to do it. I guess there are a couple extreme cases that you have heard about where, particularly with adolescents, they started egging each other on, but those are just way total outliers. People who are struggling with taking their own life, usually with the right person, they like to talk about it. And I would just say, you know, once you ask, sort of all you have to do is listen. And there's nothing that you are going to say that is going to be the last, you know, the final straw for somebody. That's just not going to be the case. So it's uncomfortable, but just listen and show you care for the person. And I am quite confident that will be helpful to them.
Greg, I read a statistic that the CDC did a big survey this summer and found that 25% of young people between the ages of 18 and 24 had thought about suicide in the last 30 days. That is breathtaking, terrible, like a sucker punch. This says to me that all of us need to be talking to all children or young people.
Yeah, and you know, nationally, the increase in the rate of suicide has been strongest in our youngest people. So between the ages of 5 and 15, it really starts out at the tiniest rate, but it's increased 200% in the past decade nationally.
Why?
And between the ages of 15 and 25, about 50%. Well, you know, why? We're living in a society that is more stressful. It's harsher. We're more polarized. And for younger people, we're really understanding the impact of social media, particularly the comparative nature of social media, that you can never, you know, no one posts their worst day on Instagram or Facebook. And so I can never measure up to all those other posts. And people don't feel like they're ever good enough. Unfortunately, I think our young people have a growing sense of a need for perfection that we can never attain. I think for me, that's part of maturing. I realize I'm never going to be perfect. But for young people, they're always chasing that really elusive perfection.
And David, is that exacerbated by the pandemic because kids are spending even more time on their phones and less time with each other?
Yeah, I think for all of us, it feels like sometimes everything in my life has been disrupted. At least that's how I feel during the pandemic. Nothing is easy and nothing is the same. I think the social media and the phones, they are part of it. It is enormously stressful being a teenager and young adult. Perhaps it has always been, but it certainly is today. Some of the expectations that we have on our young adults to figure out their life, to do well in school, to those that are looking to college, you know, to be have the best application are hard. The things I see in practice in social media, there's a whole dialogue or conversation often going around with people who are struggling with mental health or who are considering suicide that's eye-popping. Among other things that I've seen in practice, you see images or pictures of people who are holding firearms up to their head. You see pictures of people with pills spread out in front of them. It's really something to start to see this world, and I think I don't even know the half of it. But it's very concerning. The conversation is out there, and part of our job is to tap into it in a way that I think you don't violate people's privacy and sense of independence, but also address the concern.
Greg, David used the word firearm. Just a couple weeks ago, we did a program on Maine Calling talking about the growth in gun ownership in our state and in the nation. Maine, 70,000 background checks for new gun purchases through the FBI in 3 months alone. Maine is on track to have something like 128,000 more guns in the system at the end of this year. What does that mean for suicide risk?
Well, firearms are by far the most lethal. And for years, the rate of firearm suicides had been falling, and now that's reversed. Over the past 4 years, it's going back up. And if you're despondent or depressed or in a crisis, and that impulsivity leads you to grab a firearm, the likelihood of death from an attempt by firearm approaches 90%. Guns are lethal, and it's not in any way that in the prevention field we are anti-gun, but we are absolutely pro-life and pro-gun, responsible gun ownership. It's a lethal mix, suicidality and a gun.
I understand that most people who have attempted suicide and have survived are so glad they have survived. David, is this, does this resonate with you? Is this what you hear from the people that you work with?
Oh, yeah. I can still remember when I first started practicing, one of the first handful of people that I treated, after they had finished treatment with me, a short while later, they had some big stress and they attempted to take their own life and they didn't succeed. And I had, if you will, the good fortune of seeing them six or eight months after that whole thing had happened. And I asked them, I said, you know, if I find somebody else who is feeling as bad as you were feeling just a little while ago, what would you tell them? And they said to me, I remember they looked, you know, right in my eye and they said, you just tell them that even though they don't believe a word you're saying right now, that it is going to get better and that the way things look today are not the way things are always going to look. And then they made me promise a bunch of things that I could never hope to do, that I would tell every single person that I ever saw with that. It's one of the funniest things when you talk to people, not funny, but the striking things with somebody. At that moment, they do not see a whole lot of hope or a whole lot of future. They describe it kind of like tunnel vision. But people will tell me afterwards, they'll say, even though I couldn't tell you at the moment that what you were saying was helpful, it was enormously helpful. And even though I couldn't tell you that gave me a little bit of hope, it did give me a little bit of hope. So you start to learn that you say the right things at the moment, and later people can tell you how helpful that was, but sometimes not right then.
I'm going to go to Rebecca, who's calling from Freeport. Hi, Rebecca. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because I was a patient, not of one of yours, but I really appreciate that you talked about hope earlier on. When I was in my early 20s, I was finally living on my own, and my parents had a terrible divorce, and there was a lot that wasn't told to us, so we kids didn't feel very important or included or even seen. And so what happened was I called my mother. I had these pills out in front of me and called my mom. She came and she brought me home and let me kind of just recuperate in my childhood room, but didn't really talk to me. No one really talked to me. I knew they were talking about me, but not to me. And again, made me feel really invisible and small. But the reality is becoming an adult and creating things for myself, I've had the most amazing life. Mm. And I'm so glad that I didn't take my own life, because it was just something, it was a section of my life. And I've gone on to help other people too, not people who are suicidal, but other people who are going through tough times, because I have a little bit of an understanding of how to get through tough stuff.
All right, David.
Thank you for calling. I may just hang up the phone and let you finish off, Rebecca. That's put so well, and I'm glad that you got through it. It sounds like you had a life that has had some real positive and great things. And you try to get people to develop a sense of hope and a sense of future. And I think in the mental health profession, when you have that conversation, you can't really candy coat it. You just, you can't say mm-hmm. better because they're going to get better. You got to dig in there and wrestle with the kind of hard questions that we all face when we are teenagers and young adults, and sometimes later in life when life throws us a huge curveball, there are questions worth wrestling with, and there are some other answers besides there is no answer. But I think the good answers, they don't really come quickly. And your story, Rebecca, I think just illustrates that beautifully.
Rebecca, thank you so much for calling.
Go ahead. Add one more thing?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. One more really important thing that I forgot to say is because we were feeling like we were out of the loop, but me especially not feeling like what I said or was important at the time, my mom did ask me if I wanted to see a therapist, but at the time she was struggling with finances because of the divorce. And I think oftentimes a kid, especially in their teens and 20s, feels like if you're struggling with your finances, I don't want you putting any money into me. I don't want to be the reason. So if they could explain that it was money well spent.
Well, thank you so much, Rebecca. I really appreciate you calling. We are going to go to a quick break. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the City of Bath, inviting you to enjoy its restaurants, galleries, and shops. Minutes from Route 1. More at visitbath.com. And Green Hut Galleries, presenting a solo exhibition of Thomas Conley's paintings October 1st through the 31st. GreenHutGalleries.com.
President Trump has attacked his opponent's political record.
Joe Biden has been on the wrong side of history for 47 years.
Biden says four more years of Trump would mean chaos.
You are not safer in Donald Trump's America.
I'm Audie Cornish. Join us tonight for NPR's special live coverage of the first presidential debate, plus recaps and analysis tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 o'clock on both Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television. Join Maine Public, the Nature Conservancy in Maine, the Maine Education Association, and the Maine Mathematics and Science Alliance for a special lecture series around our collective relationship with the natural world around us. We are presenting free online Zoom lectures inspired by the PBS documentary The Age of Nature, exploring how humans have shaped and affected Maine's rivers, forests, and ocean. Register now at mainepublic.org. Please click on the Events tab. Our next lecture, Flow, the Ripple Effect of Restoring the Nature of Rivers in Maine, is this Thursday at 12 noon. And the featured speaker is Laura Rose Day, President and CEO, Seven Lakes Alliance. Please register now for this lecture and also for invites to the Rivers Lecture and Ocean Lectures that follow. Again, at mainepublic.org, click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, recognizing suicide risk and learning how to help. My guest, Dr. David Prescott, clinical psychologist at Northern Light Acadia Hospital, and Greg Marley, who is a clinical social worker with NAMI Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is Newell Louie with Wabanaki Public Health. Thanks so much for calling in, Newell.
Pleasure to be here.
Tell us what your organization does, especially in terms of mental health care.
Yes, thank you. So Wabanaki Public Health, we are an organization that reaches out to the Native communities in Maine. And we have a number of projects out there that try to assist and help Maine Natives. And the pandemic has brought a lot of that to light.
I wanted to ask you that. Are there particular challenges in the Wabanaki community that lead to depression and suicide risk?
There are, and we're working hard to amend some of those. Like we have had community smudges, which are a smudge that is, a smudge is a form of prayer for the Wabanaki communities. And we had to readjust and rethink how we were going to do that in the pandemic to reach out to people. And we have those with a people that are mobile in a truck, and then we go and do the smudge throughout the community. And we have people coming to the street to be out there with us, as well as live streaming online, like a lot of things in the pandemic. And we've reached a lot of people. And people have said that they have felt more at ease, and we're very grateful to have these smudges taking place in our community.
What can people do for others or themselves to help prevent suicide? What would you say to those in the Wabanaki community listening right now?
Well, I would say that, you know, not educate yourself, but get aware, make yourself aware of how you can be effective to reach out to other people. I think one of the folks on your show here was just talking about saying the wrong thing. Well, saying the wrong thing sometimes could be not saying anything. Mm-hmm. So be aware of what is happening around you, how people are feeling, how they present. And, you know, we have an Elders Colored Paper Project where people can just put out a sign that says, you know, they need some assistance, they need a visit, they need water, et cetera. So just be aware of what's happening around you and reach out. And don't be afraid to do so, because not doing it could be also detrimental.
Well, thank you so much. That was Newell Louie with Wabanaki Public Health. I appreciate you calling today, Newell, for this program. I'm going to move on now, go to Connie, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Connie. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer. Thank you so much for having this program. You don't know how great it is that with a stigma like this, that you're so brave, should I say, to have something like this. I feel I'm also sort of brave to put my name and where I live, because I'm very it's a very quiet kind of illness. No one sees it. You know, if you break your ankle, well, you know where to go. But if you go to you have a mental health, you don't want to say anything. So it's a real struggle for me. I struggle with it every day. I have a face for outside, and I have a face for inside. And the outside face is a happy face, whatever. But that's really not how I'm feeling inside. I think no one can really tell you, or they can really notice anything, unless you are free to say that you are not safe. It's a four-letter word that starts with an S that is not, you can't tell anybody that you're not safe. The mental health here in Biddeford, Maine Behavioral Health, is closed. I cannot get in there because I don't have a special insurance, and it really bothers me that I have nothing that I can go to hang some of my frustrations and some of my stress onto them so that they can help me. They will not allow me to go in there. It's a locked facility. Yet the CEO puts out a beautiful editorial in the Press Herald about mental health and how important it is and everything, but yet she has that big building all blocked for people that have mental health but don't have the proper insurance. So I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do. But every day I have conflicts, Jennifer, with the way my mind works. And my mind is not healthy. I know that. But I'm also very safe with who I can tell. And I can't believe I have to tell you.
Oh, Connie, I'm so sorry to hear. I can just hear the hurt in your voice. Greg, what would you tell Connie? Where can she turn?
Connie, I am so sad. I'm so glad you called today. And one of the things I'm going
to
suggest.
I spend my day around this.
Yeah. One, I'm going to suggest call our helpline here at NAMI. And we can't work miracles, but we can try and get doors open to get you the help you need. And it's 622-5767.
And I did write NAMI in Hollowell a letter, but she never responded. So, you know, I just keep trying to reach out, but it's just been really struggle every day.
Connie, Connie, did you get that number? Would
yes,
you like
ma'am.
To have
yes,
Greg
Jennifer,
repeat it?
I did.
Okay, wonderful.
5767.
Great.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Yeah, and Connie, while you're still on the line, David, I want to talk to you about what Connie said about the face that she puts on the outside and how she's really feeling on the inside. The first part of this program, we were discussing looking for signs, looking for warning signs. Connie's trying really hard to hide warning signs.
Yeah. And Connie, you said it just so beautifully. It's something that a lot of people who are struggling will tell me, you know, first thing. And that face probably has a purpose. In a way, there are times where you don't want, just because you got to get through your day, to go into depth about what's going on. But as you pointed out so beautifully, that other part is right there. And finding a place where you can show that side of yourself, too, is where you start to feel like maybe you're not so all alone with that part of you. But it's really common. You said it, you know, just as articulately as it could be. That's exactly what I hear from person after person.
Connie, good luck to you. Thank you for having the courage of calling in today. Please give the number, call the number that Greg gave you, and I wish you all the best in confronting this horrible feeling that you're going through and coming out to the other side, so that you feel like our previous caller who talks about how glad she is that she stuck with it and made it through. I'm going to move along now. I'm going to move to Frederick, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Frederick. Go ahead.
Hi, boy. Can you hear me okay?
I'm in
the car. Well, first of all, best wishes to Connie. What a strong woman to call in. I was just wanting to know if the professionals on the program today are integrating mindfulness practices, you know, where we focus and stay with our breath and notice where our mind is taking us. And we basically objectify or separate our thinking, our well-being from what our mind is saying to us. And in the words of Thich Nhat Hanh, we would then identify, let's say, oh, I see you loneliness, or I see you depression. And then we can deal with it as if we're actually dealing with someone in the room, where we begin to take care of that with aspect of our feeling side. And of course, there's a practice that goes along with this. I'd be very interested to hear the professionals address their experience with this. Thanks.
Sure. David?
Yeah. Thank you for your call. I'm a big fan of mindfulness. I think it has so much to teach us, both at a person who is just learning about that approach and that way of being aware of yourself for the first time, or somebody that has practiced being more mindful for many weeks or months. One of the things that it's nice for, and to relate it to Connie's call, is that it takes a whole lot of energy for you to not tune into those parts of yourself that are lonely or are depressed, right? And keeping up that face, the other thing people tell me is it takes an enormous amount of emotional and physical energy. And mindfulness allows us, I think, just to accept it. And once you're in there, then it'll be amazing. Your mind will start to come up with ideas about what you might do about it. So it is, I think, been just a real positive addition to the different kinds of approaches and ideas and techniques we use in mental health treatment. I'm really glad that Frederick called in.
Mm. I'm going to go to Friedrichs calling from Milo. Hi, Friedrichs. Go ahead.
Hello. What justification gives the right to judge suicide? Are we talking religion? I have more questions.
Friedrichs, what do you can you clarify what you mean by that?
Well, obviously it's an objection to suicide, and eventually I'm going to go to the right to die. Carry
sure.
on.
Sure, Friedrichs, and I certainly hope that you don't think any of us are being judgmental, but as David so eloquently talked about earlier, the vast majority of people who attempt suicide are glad when they have not succeeded, right, David?
Right. That's true. And I don't know, Greg, you may have comments about this.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead?
So most people I've talked to, I worked for years doing crisis work with people who were just really struggling in the moment. And when it comes down to it, they don't want to die. They want to end the way they feel right now. They want to stop the pain, and they're looking for relief. And that crisis is around not being able to find a different way of dealing with the pain other than ending their life. We want to give people choices. Even in the end of life, Friedrich, we want to give people choices about how they live the rest of their life, whether it's 2 days or 2 years.
All right. Well, thank you. Go ahead quickly, please.
Well, there are choices made by chemicals called happy pills. Are we willing to subsidize that?
There are treatments. Some of them are medication-based. Many of them are things like mindfulness and skill building in terms of trying to train your mind to recognize what's real and what's fear-based. So I kind of shudder at the idea of happy pills because I don't think we're there.
Friedrich, thanks for your call. We do need to go to another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bristol Seafood's My Fish Dish, lemon and herb butter, North Atlantic scallops, and three other varieties found in the freezer at your local Hannaford, by Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, inviting you to escape to blissful blooms and relaxing landscapes. Learn more at MaineGardens.org. And Bar Harbor Chamber of Commerce, encouraging you to plan a safe autumn getaway. Visit barharbor.com.
Artist Winslow Homer died at Prout's Neck on September 29, 1910. Largely self-taught, Homer began his career working as a commercial illustrator. He subsequently took up oil painting and also worked extensively in watercolor, primarily chronicling his working vacations. In 1883, he settled at Prout's Neck, where he would live for the rest of his life. He traveled widely to the Adirondacks, Canada, Bermuda, Florida, and the Caribbean. In all those places, painting the watercolors upon which much of his later fame would be based. In 1890, he painted the first of the series of seascapes at Prout's Neck that were the most admired of his late paintings in oil.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine!
The Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus is on a twice-a-week schedule, on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On these 2 days, it will normally happen at 2 o'clock each weekday afternoon. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, the briefings are archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw is expected to happen shortly at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling and carried here on Maine Public Radio as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today's topic, we are talking about suicide prevention and awareness, especially during this pandemic. Joining me, Greg Marley with NAMI Maine and Dr. David Prescott with Northern Light Acadia Hospital. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Tom, who's calling from Lewiston. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I would love for you folks to address the suicide rates among our lesbian, gay, bi, queer, questioning, and transgendered youth. I think that there's a disproportionate rate of attempted suicide and suicide among this group, and along with people who are suffering from crisis mental health situations, our children need to know that despite whatever's going on with them and in their self-discovery of who they may be sexually, that it does get better, and they need to hear that. And I think that that everybody needs to know about resources like the Trevor Project or Gay Straight Alliances in schools and whatnot. But the fact of the matter, on the website, it says that lesbian, gay, and bi youth seriously contemplate suicide almost three times the rate of heterosexual youth. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Tom, thank you so much for that call. And Greg, I'll turn to you for a response.
Yeah, and Tom, I want to, you know, 2 to 3 times higher for attempts among lesbian, gay, bisexual, and even higher, 4 to 5 times among those youth who are transgender or not sure of their gender identity. I'm totally with you. I have been hopeful for years to see that risk lower as we become a more accepting society. And there are parts of Maine where it's getting better. Along the coast and in southern part of the state, but in rural, more isolated northern western part of the state, young people especially are still very much struggling. We don't have good data on suicide rates because we don't know that on someone's birth certificate. We certainly know about the attempt rates, and lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender groups are one of my main concerns. So gay, straight, trans alliances, civil rights teams in schools, really important. There's some wonderful work going on, and we're about to engage in some additional training specifically within the queer community and those people who support as allies coming up in the next year.
Tom, thank you so much for your call. And Greg, I want to talk about some other groups of people that seem to be at higher risk for suicide. And one of those groups is men, right?
Yeah. Almost 4 out of 5 deaths by suicide are among men. And if you think about the concept of manliness that we have in this culture, it's that strong, silent, not really acknowledging pain. And it's a bottleneck and a trap for my gender. So we've been working really hard at how do we encourage and find the openings for men to say ouch when they feel ouch and reach out. We have just gotten funding, and we're about to roll out an initiative with a great group called Man Therapy. They were based out of Colorado, and it's targeting that particularly the highest risk group of men, which are those who are more blue collar, working with their hands, less kind of educated typically, and they're the ones that are least able to kind of reach out and connect with someone when they're struggling. And Man Therapy has an incredible website that uses humor, and it's targeted for folks who are much more interested in things like barbecue and sports and fishing and hunting than it is in folks who are interested in meditation and yoga and mindfulness and group hugs. And how do you engage them? With humor and with good information and to connect them with resources. So I'm really excited that Man Therapy is coming to Maine.
And David, I read this morning that caregivers and frontline workers are also at higher risk, which isn't surprising during this really, really, really frightening crisis, but also that even very highly educated frontline workers, such as doctors.
Yeah. Some of the highest suicide rates in our country are among the physicians and other types of medical doctors. Lawyers, dentists are at surprisingly high risk, if you look at that. And we worry a great deal. These are people who are enormously accomplished in their professional lives. They're really good at figuring things out and really good at getting things done. And for them to have this part of their life that starts to grow and grow inside is usually very scary for them. They have a real hard time talking about it, as many people do. But they're among the highest risk groups. And I've been working in Maine for a while. There have been several people who have been enormously courageous, like some of our callers that come at talking about their own contemplation of suicide. Some family members, where they're a doctor or a lawyer or another professional who've committed suicide, their family members have come out and talked about their private struggle. It's there, and it's the amount of tension and frustration that some of these folks feel is beyond belief.
A tweet here from Tim: the Maine statewide crisis line is the line to call when in crisis. 1-888-569-1112.
568. It's 568.
Oh, so Tim's wrong. 1-888-568-1112.
Yes.
All right. I will make sure we get that on properly on our Facebook page and on our main calling webpage, so people who want to look it up will find the proper number. Thank you so much for jumping in there. I'm going to go to Cassandra, who's calling from Belgrade. Hi, Cassandra. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. You are a really lovely host.
Thank you.
I attempted suicide in 91 after I had told my psychiatrist that I was going to do it. I was very clear about it. I ended up in a coma for 4 days in intensive care for a week and then in a locked psych down ward for a month. So I know that a lot of things have changed. And what I want to tell people is it took me about 20 years to not be angry that I wasn't successful, to be honest. Because I'm in chronic pain and I wasn't able to resolve that issue. But going into 12-step recovery really helped me because I needed to be with people who had some similar experiences. Maybe not exactly, but I didn't find a lot of help with professionals, to be honest. And I still haven't, and I recently tried a professional. I just believe more in the model of people helping people who have had the same experience and have been successful, and role modeling and getting a mentor in that environment was really helpful for me.
Mm. Thank you so much, Cassandra, for calling. David, what would you like to add to that?
I'm glad chronic pain is just relentless. And if that's what you're dealing with, that's understandable that sometimes you think that I just don't want to do this anymore. I'm really glad you brought up that point. There's one of the things I try to do, and I think most mental health professionals try to do, is be a little bit humble about what we do and to say to people, you know, I'm going to talk to you for a while, but if you don't think I'm the person that it's going to work out for you, let me help you find somebody else. And I will say to folks looking for services, that is an expectation of all of us who work in this field. You should be able to have that conversation with your therapist. And sometimes, you know, I'm just not the right person. And if Cassandra found a community of people that had, you know, could really, when they said, I think I understand, she really felt like, yeah, I think you do. That's a really, really good thing. And I'm really glad you did. And you must have a lot of grit for hanging in there for that many years. That's a long struggle. And tip of my hat to you on that.
Thank you. Yeah. It was the way my parents raised me.
They were.
And
yeah.
Plus, I do find joy, so much joy. And I always said, if I can find 5 minutes of joy once a day, I'm going to hang in there one more day. And nature is what does it for me. And I've gone back to my belief in God from my childhood, which I had completely separated from for about 40 years. So I just want to tell people that I was a tough case. I was depressed when I was a kid because my parents were both every night blackout drinkers, but highly functional. And it really is possible, but you have to be patient and be easy on yourself.
Thank you so much, Cassandra, for calling in. We're going to go to Lori calling from Washington County. Hi, Lori.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. As a teenager, I struggled with seasonal affective disorder. I had 2 failed suicide attempts. I was really fortunate that I had a friend intervene and get me some help. And I did a stint as an inpatient. And then I went through some outpatient therapy. But what I found to be most helpful as a teenager was actually family therapy, so that everybody in my group had the same message and it was clear and concise, and I felt like I had an alliance, you know. And then as an adult, I had a daughter who at 16 had a psychotic break and was diagnosed as type 1 bipolar. And again, you know, in her therapy, we all sat in as a family and everybody had the same message and everybody had the same goals, and she didn't feel alone, you know, and we all went through the struggle together rather than, you know, alone. So I would just stress that, you know, if you have a youngster, a young adult, a teenager that's going through depression, family therapy is so beneficial, because it's not their issue. It's everybody's issue, and everybody's on board and on the same page as far as how to make things better for them.
Lori, thank you for your call. David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks a lot, Lori. That's good. I'm glad you brought that up because it does a whole lot of things. It lets the problem, you know, becomes one that the whole family has to rally around and support. And that feels pretty good if you're the person who may be struggling the most at that point. I also think you sound pretty brave, you know, going in with your family. The emotional level usually in family therapy sessions is pretty high. I mean, any of our listeners, just think about going in with either your current family or the family you grew up in, and everybody's sitting around talking about the parts of your life that are most stressful. It's really hard work. And I'm so glad that you found that helpful and that you then, you know, went in with your own daughter. I suspect that's going to really help a lot, both immediately and in the long term.
Lori, thank you. I want to try to squeeze in one more. Let's see, where did that go? Here it is. An email from Shelby. Hello, I was diagnosed with bipolar 1 in college. I'm now 27 years old, and the biggest stressors that have exacerbated my suicidal ideation attempts are financial. I'm crippled with student debt and have gone without mental health care on and off due to access and the general state of the country. The media is full of falsehood. Science is tainted by politics. Women's health care is under attack. As a young person, I do not see the role of social media as you presented. I actually see growing body positivity and breaking down of all kinds of stigma, including mental health and gender in my generation. If social media is contributing, it's because we're bombarded with people calling attention to the very real injustices we are facing. I know this isn't fair, Greg. We only have about 45 seconds, but this is a really, really stressful time in the world, in our country.
It is a hugely stressful time. And, you know, if there is one thing that's clear from all the callers coming in, it's not one size fits all. But how do you break isolation so that you know you're not alone, you find a community that supports you and that supports your growth, and you hold on. And if you're worried about somebody else, you reach out and you connect with them for that same connection, support, oneness, and helping them hold on. Because this is a time where we need to endure and support each other, whether that's online, in person, masked. We need to support each other.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us for the hour. The voice you just heard, Greg Marley, Clinical Director and Director of Suicide Prevention for the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Maine. And David Prescott, Clinical Psychologist at Northern Light Acadia Hospital. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Stay with us for the Maine CDC press briefing with Director Nirav Shah. And don't forget that Maine Calling moves to a new time next week. Beginning Monday, we will be on at 11 a.m., 11 till noon, Monday through Friday. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.